From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. We're following the latest vote counts in several key states as the race for president inches closer to a decisive moment. And that could come in Pennsylvania, where the tally so far shows Democratic nominee Joe Biden leading President Trump by just over 12,000 votes. But more than 120,000 mail-in ballots remain to be counted in the state. Let's bring in Katie Meyer. She's a political reporter with WHYY in Philadelphia. And Katie, start by giving us the latest there. What's the state of the race right now, and what can we expect for the rest of the day?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, we're in a little bit of a holding pattern right now. As you mentioned, we've got a vote update. Looks like Biden's ahead by over 12,000 votes. I do think there's probably a few fewer ballots left to count than that number you just cited, just because, you know, those counts haven't been updated quite as frequently. But I think the fact remains there are still ballots left to count, and we're waiting to see what happens. And I should also note, I mean, the Trump campaign has made it very clear that whatever the count ends up being, they intend to contest it, and they've filed a number of lawsuits.
Yeah, and I'm going to talk with you a little bit more about those lawsuits in just a moment. But let's talk a little bit about some of those crucial areas, including Philadelphia and Allegheny counties. What can you tell us about the votes and the ballots and those that still need to be counted there?
Sure. I mean, these are ballots that have been skewed dramatically toward Biden. We expected that. First of all, Philadelphia and Allegheny are Pennsylvania's two biggest, or Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, I should say, which is in Allegheny. Those are Pennsylvania's two biggest cities. So they're very blue areas already. And mail ballots overall across the entire state have skewed Biden because just more Democrats voted by mail in Pennsylvania. And, you know, the Republican Party was pretty much actively discouraging people from doing that. So, you know, that's kind of a very clear trend we've seen. We've been seeing Biden, these ballots coming in for Biden in like sort of the 80-85% range, which is, you know, well over what he needed to, you know, catch up to Trump's lead from in-person votes and to get ahead, which is what has happened. And so we are expecting that trend to continue.
Yeah. So there's Pittsburgh and there's Philadelphia, skews heavily Democratic. But what about some of those areas that don't? Does there appear to be any pathway for President Trump to regain the lead in the state?
I mean, listen, it's not a big margin here, but what we've been seeing is that, you know, the mail ballots that come in, even from very red parts of the state, have skewed toward Biden. That's just, you know, the trend that we've seen overwhelmingly across the state. I should say, I mean, and Joe Biden did cut into just in the returns that we've been seeing from counties that have reported a lot of them. Biden cut into Trump's margins in those areas anyway. There are certainly some counties where Trump did, you know, better than he had, a lot of the rural, very red counties in Pennsylvania. But for instance, Northampton County, Erie County, both of which Trump flipped in 2016, those with almost all the votes in have appeared to flip back to Biden. So, you know, you're seeing, you know, very strong trends that favor Biden across the state. So, again, I mean, we still have these lawsuits. There are ballots at issue here. So I'm not trying to, like, say that things couldn't change.
Sure,
but just
sure.
Very strong, consistent trends.
Well, tell me a little bit more about the Trump campaign lawsuits. They filed several of them. Do any of those stand a chance of influencing the outcome of the race there?
Yeah, there are a bunch of them. Some of them have to do with just the methods of counting ballots. Some of them are contesting specific swaths of ballots that, for instance, like voters were able to correct. I think, though, the biggest one that's going to have the largest impact potentially has to do with a 3-day extension Pennsylvania's Supreme Court gave to the state to accept mail ballots that came in after the November 3rd deadline. So basically, if the ballots were postmarked by November 3rd, but they came in up until 5 p.m. today, counties were able to tabulate them and add them to their totals. That was because of mail delays. The Republicans said that that was an overreach by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which is controlled by Democrats, and they appealed that up to the U.S. Supreme Court twice now. Both times they were unsuccessful. The court threw it out. Second time they said it was too close to the election, but some conservative justices did say they thought the case had merit. So now they are appealing it right back up to the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, a different case, but same sort of situation. And, you know, we're going to have to see what happens with that. I mean, I think it really depends on how many ballots are at issue here. And it doesn't look like it's that many, but we do not have a count on how many have come in late.
That's WHYY political reporter Katie Meyer. Thank you so much for this update.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So that's the view from Pennsylvania. Let's take a look at the big picture now with NPR senior editor Ron Elving. Ron, we just heard from Katie kind of what's happening there in Pennsylvania, but could you add any more insight into why, you know, now that Joe Biden is in the lead and it appears to be growing, what's keeping the state from officially being called?
The count is still just a hair below 50% in terms of Biden's share of the overall vote. Now, that's not necessary. You don't have to go over 50% if you have the plurality. And oftentimes in a close vote in a state, because there are third party candidates, the winner does not go over 50%. But it just would feel better, I think, for an awful lot of people who are watching all of this anxiously. Of course, they're eager to call the race. The overall national race, of course, could be called if you called Pennsylvania, but at the same time, anxious in the sense that you just don't want to be premature about anything in the midst of all of this, you know, fraughtness, as somebody once called it.
Well, it is important to be careful. So in that respect, let's take a look at the map right now, take a look at some of the states that are still outstanding. Why don't you start with Georgia? What are you seeing?
Georgia is remarkable. This is probably the one that surprises more people than any other because while the president seemed to have a substantial lead there on election night, Wednesday morning, it just melted away as it did in other states as the voting by mail ballots were opened and counted. And so in Georgia, overnight, Joe Biden moved ahead of the president, not just catching up, but moved ahead and is now ahead by less than 2,000 votes. One of the vote officials down there said about the size of a large high school. And that could wind up being the margin in the end, not necessarily for Biden, though, because they are still counting ballots and they have ballots coming in from the military and ballots from people overseas. And those will probably take a little while to count. Georgia may be very late in finally making a call, but it could go either way. And that's another 16 electoral college votes.
Yeah. And Georgia may very well end up in a recount. So let's go west. Just quickly, what are you seeing in both Arizona and Nevada?
Arizona has been, I think, in some respects, the most interesting. The Associated Press called it on election night, and Fox News called it on election night, both for Biden, saying that while it was a very narrow lead that he had opened there, the areas from which voting by mail ballots were going to arrive from, those areas of the state were among its most Democratic. Maricopa County, though, is a complex county. It's very large. It's Phoenix, but also its suburbs. And so as a result of that, those ballots that have come in by mail have been pretty close. They haven't been contributing to the lead for Biden the way they have in other states. In fact, they've actually shrunk it. And we've actually seen some other counties come in that helped the Trump's side a little bit as well. So the president has actually closed the gap there down to about 44,000 votes. That's still more than double the margin that Biden is winning by in Wisconsin. But there are still a lot of votes out there. So Republicans have been saying all along, we're going to get Arizona back. We're going to flip that one back red. So we'll see. At this point, no one's retracted their call on it, but no one has added a call from some of the other news organizations. And we may have to stick around fairly well into the evening before we have enough from Arizona to make a final call.
So that's the map that the Trump campaign is looking at, including in Nevada, as we mentioned, increasingly falling behind Joe Biden. Now, Trump campaign lawyer Matt Morgan said in a statement today that this election is not over. He warned against what he called a false projection before the results are finalized. Where are we with the legal challenges? We heard about some of them in Pennsylvania a moment ago, but when you look at the whole country, where do these legal challenges stand?
They are in various locations, they're in various jurisdictions, they're in the hands of scores of different officials and different courts. One thing they have not done is stop the count. And so the count has gone forward with some interruptions here and there, some hours out, some periods of time, even of a day in which a particular venue did not count ballots. But now they're going forward, and they're going forward pretty much everywhere and just about everywhere, with that exception of Arizona. The longer the count goes on, the more of these ballots come in by mail, the more they turn out to have been cast by Democrats, as totally expected, since the president told his supporters to vote on Election Day or vote in person before Election Day and not to vote by mail. And the Democrats said, hey, the safest thing is just vote by mail. And so a lot of Democrats did. So as they open them and the count goes forward, we have seen the change from what we were seeing on Tuesday night and Wednesday morning.
Yeah. Ron Elving, what are we expecting from the Biden campaign today?
Later this evening, we expect Joe Biden to come out and make a statement. It is not necessarily going to claim victory, although if Pennsylvania can be called, if his margin there improves a little bit more and he goes over 50% of the vote, and we anticipate that the remaining vote is going to come primarily from places where he's winning and winning big, that call may be made by enough folks that by a former vice president feels confident in claiming victory tonight. We don't know that. We're just thinking that's a prospect, that's a possibility. And there are other ways that he could get to 270 as well, so we'll be watching.
We certainly will be. NPR senior editor Ron Elving, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
The presidential race is still undecided, and we're watching as the vote count continues in several key states. But last night in the White House briefing room, President Trump falsely claimed he'd already won and made a series of baseless claims about the vote counting process.
If you count the legal votes, I easily win. If you count the illegal votes, they can try to steal the election from us. If you count the votes that came in late, we're looking at them very strongly, but a lot of votes came in late.
There is no evidence to support any of what the president said just then. Jennifer Murcia joins us now. She's an associate professor in the Department of Communication at Texas A&M University, and she's the author of Demagogue for President: The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. And she joins us via Skype. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Jennifer, it's almost dizzying to listen to the president's comments from last night. What was your overall impression of his remarks?
Well, that he's failing and he's flailing. he's you know, grasping for straws. He's using conspiracy theory, as he does. He's very comfortable wielding conspiracy theory. And it was very predictable that he would do this. We knew that this is what he intended to do, to deny reality and to claim victory, even though there was no evidence of that.
Well, this certainly wasn't the first time that the president has publicly said things that are just flat out untrue. But did he take it to another level last night?
It's an interesting question. I did see, I think it was Daniel Dale said that this was his least factful speech. You know, I think it's difficult to gauge that. But, you know, the thing about conspiracy theory is that it makes him powerful and has done historically. He is a connoisseur of conspiracy theory. He's a purveyor of conspiracy theory. And the thing that makes it work for him is that you cannot prove or disprove a conspiracy theory because evidence isn't allowed to count against it. And so yesterday, Donald Trump claimed many things. He offered no evidence, but he didn't need to because he was making implications and he was making accusations. And that has worked for him traditionally. But I don't see it working for him this time.
I mean, but you actually use the word genius in your book when it comes to the way that the president talks to the American public and how he uses language. What is it about the way he speaks that attracts support?
Yeah, that's such a it's a fascinating question to me. So, you know, in 2015, Donald Trump took advantage of pre-existing distrust and polarization and frustration, and he used rhetorical strategies that, you know, are frankly dangerous to democracy, you know, but were well calculated to take advantage of that distrust and polarization and frustration and to use it to his own advantage. And he's continued to do that. So what we saw him do last night was to try to sow more distrust in the process.
You know, your area of expertise is American political discourse, and I feel like we have spent the last 4 years talking about how President Trump talks. Should we label his falsehoods lies, just straight up lies? Of course, many media organizations have been working to fact check him in real time. We actually saw many news outlets do that last night, including NPR. But maybe the bigger question, do you think President Trump's rhetoric will have long-term impacts on the way presidents address the public or how the public perceives the president's statements?
Yeah, I do think that media organizations should call his lies lies. I think that's important and useful. I think they should continue to fact check him. The thing is about calling them lies and fact checking is that it's not going to pierce the media bubble of Trump supporters. When they hear, you know, media call lies or do fact checks, they see that as part of, you know, the dishonest establishment, the corruption of the process, that the media is fake news and out against Trump. But I still think it's important to do it because I think that we need to have a record of reality. And I think that Donald Trump is really excellent at denying reality and creating, you know, the world as he would like it to exist. He's a marketing genius. He's not a business genius, but he's really excellent at marketing. And so he has used those marketing skills to his advantage in politics. And I think it's really important that someone hold him accountable for that.
Jennifer Murcia is associate professor in the Department of Communication at Texas A&M University. She's the author of Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. Jennifer, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Well, the president's speech last night also made a splash on social media, where just about every human emotion was on display as people tried to cope with the long days of uncertainty over the election. Femi Okeh is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, and she joins us now. Femi, what do you think? What did people on social media have to say about the president's speech?
Let me start on Facebook. The White House streamed live on President Trump's Facebook page. There was so much support for the president, also some ridicule. Let me start with some support from Jenny Mutters. She says, thank you, Mr. President, for all of your hard work. We know the real truth of what's happening right now. We love and support you. And don't forget, Satan thought he'd won until 3 days later. Just hang tight. That is a Trump supporter, of course. Facebook are watching very carefully what the president is posting. So on the Facebook clips of the president's speech, which are broken up into little points and highlights, it actually notes, Facebook notes, that election results are taking longer right now, warning people that they're not going to come out in a day or 2 days, and that there are laws to protect the integrity of elections. So basically pushing back about what the president was saying in his speech. Facebook also banned a group called Stop the Steal, a group of conservative activists who are alleging widespread voter fraud. You will also see that hashtag on Twitter. And let me just give you a little Twitter review of the president's speech from yesterday. Yeah. Jessica Valenti, she's kind of channeling a lot of thoughts about what the president was doing, how he was feeling, what he looked like. She said, this is a very low energy attempt at a coup. And then there was a lot of love for CNN's Addison Cooper, who watched the president's speech and said quite simply at the end of it, an obese turtle on his back, flailing in the hot sun, realizing his time is over. That was tweeted, retweeted, and illustrated, Peter.
Well, and I don't know how someone like Anderson Cooper is even making witty comments like that on Twitter. He's been on the air for like 24 hours straight. I'm not sure how he has the brain power for it. And it has been a long week, hasn't it, Femi? I mean, how are people coping with the stress of the weight of not knowing?
Well, as a social media community, we are being very supportive of each other. For instance, on governing.com, if you really cannot take your mind off the election, you can go to the live on webcams election officials count, and you can watch various ballots being counted. It actually is like watching kind of sheep jumping over a fence. That is quite calming, depending on whether your state's count has been tallied yet. Matt Shoby posts, he says, I'm starting at season one of The Sopranos and just rewatching it. That's helping me. And I can highly recommend New York Times Election Distractor, Peter.
All right. Well, I know you've been watching as people take out some of that frustration that you're just talking about on places like poor little Nevada. No offense to Nevada. I love it there. But what are you seeing about how slow the vote, the count is rather in Nevada? How's that going over?
There are some beautiful memes, of course, right now for election 2020. But the Nevada memes, I would say they win the internet. They basically boil down to variations on the rest of America anxiously waiting for Nevada to finish counting and Nevada taking its time. Liz Jenkins got over 300,000 likes. Her tweet went viral about Nevada memes. So she tweeted very, very simply, Nevada counting ballots. And then under those comments, she posted this.
One, you're like a dream come true. Two, just want to be with you. Three, girl, it's plain to see that you're the only one.
Okay.
That's relaxing, isn't it? Liz Jenkins describes herself as an R&B lover first and an actress second. That literally made me spill my tea. It's really funny, and lots of people on the internet really loved it. Go and look out for the Nevada memes. There are lots there.
Again, I just want to say poor Nevada, because they're doing their job. They're doing this count the right way. And no matter how long it takes, we're going to know they're doing it the right way. So thank you, Nevada, for doing that. I know people are listening there. Just briefly, Femi, give us a sense of how the world is responding to all of this in the United States.
With shock, bemusement, and a little bit of smugness, Gathara is a great example. He is a cartoonist in Kenya, and he tweeted recently, breaking, African envoys have been called to America to maintain peace during the elections and to be prepared to accept the outcome of the vote. In a joint statement, the diplomats condemned recent incidents of incitement, violence, and intimidation directed at opposition supporters. There is nothing untrue in that tweet. It's really flipping the script for how America often sees elections overseas.
Interesting. Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thank you. You know, it's been a while since I've been able to laugh and smile, have a little fun.
Yeah,
thank you
same
so much.
Here. I'm crying in the corner. But we have social media to help us.
The U.S. added 638,000 jobs in October, according to Labor Department figures released today, and that helped lower the unemployment rate by a full percentage point. For more, let's go to Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. And Mike, the unemployment rate came down to 6.9% in October from 7.9% in September. Break the latest numbers down for us. Is this good news for the economy?
Yeah, this particular report, Tanya, certainly is good news. Both the number of jobs that were added back into the economy was higher than what economists expected. And what's important about the big drop in the unemployment rate is that the labor force participation rate, in other words, the percentage of the population who is actually in the workforce or looking for work, that actually rose a little bit too. So it's good to see that number rising and the unemployment rate coming down. Still, though, the labor market is very far from being completely healed, Tanya, and there are a lot of question marks ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to put this latest number in context that there were 1.5 million fewer people unemployed last month, according to the Labor Department. But are we anywhere close to making up for all the jobs we lost so far?
Not really. If you look at the total number of jobs in the country, we lost about 22 million jobs just between February and April. We've added about 12 million of those jobs back, so a little more than half of what we lost. But the number of total jobs is still about almost 7% below the peak number of jobs in February. So to put that in perspective, that's further below the peak in jobs than we were at the worst part of the global financial crisis in 2008, 2009. So this is still a very depressed job market for sure.
Yeah. What industries were responsible, though, for these new hires last month? Which sectors of the economy are actually doing okay?
So the real focus, both on the losses and the rebound, has been sort of the restaurant and bar jobs. If you look at what the Labor Department lumps them into a big category of leisure and hospitality, and includes those jobs, restaurants and bars, but also stuff like arts and entertainment and recreation. That category increased by 271,000 in October. Since April, they've added back about 4.8 million jobs, but still down by 3.5 million from February. And the big question is what happens now, because a lot of that economic activity that brought those jobs back was stuff that was moved outdoors during the warmer weather, you know, restaurant jobs in particular. Now, with the virus raging again and the weather cooling off, there is a big question about whether that rebound in jobs in those sectors can be maintained or might start going the other way and start seeing decreases in jobs again for the rest of the year.
I mean, that's the big fear moving forward. I mean, this is the fourth straight month that we've seen the rate of new job growth slow down. That's a real concern.
It is a concern. And again, you know, it all puts the focus on this colder weather and how much that will sort of be a depressing factor to the labor market. And remember, a lot of those emergency federal aid programs for the unemployed, they expire at the end of next month, and it doesn't look like Congress is really ready to agree on anything to provide more support for the unemployed.
That's Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
As America watched the election results trickle in over the past few days, one thing is abundantly clear. There are deep divides within our nation. After a year of nationwide protests over systemic racism and police brutality, many people see the problem of racism differently. So far, an estimated 69 million people voted for President Trump, despite his failure to condemn white supremacy. And the majority of those voters are white Americans. Let's take a deeper look at the role of racism in this election with Robin DiAngelo, author of White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. Robin, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Tanya.
The view from many, especially people of color, is that for about half of the electorate, Trump's racist rhetoric and support for white supremacy wasn't a deal breaker. What does this say for you?
That the foundation of this country is racism and white supremacy, that many, many white people are deeply invested in it. And so it is not a deal breaker. I think the post-racial discourse we had during the Obama years is over, and it's been laid bare, and we have some reckoning.
Let's go deeper into what you're saying, that people are deeply invested in racism. When we talked to Trump supporters during the campaign, many of them said they were supporting the president because they believed he was best positioned to rebuild the economy. But we actually heard a Trump supporter from Georgia on NPR yesterday who said, "The far left is fixated on problems that don't affect the majority of Americans." And he was alluding to the problem of racism in this country. What's the disconnect in the way people view President Trump's racist policies and rhetoric, and really the problem with systemic racism in this country?
Well, one really key issue that's revealed in this person's statement is not understanding that systemic racism hurts white people. It compels us to vote against our own interests, to deny programs that could deeply support us, but that we see as, you know, special rights for people who don't deserve them.
But building on that, can you break down why addressing systemic racism is good for all people and not just people of color?
Because we can be manipulated against our own best interests. You know, there is a greater concentration of wealth in fewer hands than has ever been recorded in human history. And yet our attention is drawn to the most vulnerable. Of course, that helps ameliorate the sense of powerlessness we might feel. It's certainly easier to look at vulnerable people and blame them. But that sets us up to be manipulated to support programs or not support programs that could actually serve everybody.
Mm. During the campaign, polls suggested that white women voters were actually turning against Trump, but the president actually gained his support among white women to about 55%. I mean, Trump seemingly won them with his message of law and order and raising fears about violence in the streets of America's suburbs. Talk a little bit about the role of fear in stoking racial tensions.
There is a long history of white women aligning with patriarchy. I mean, we are second-class citizens in relation to patriarchy, but when we align with it, then we have some adjacency to power. At the same time, we are still above somebody else. We're still above black and brown people. There are many very consistent strategies that Trump uses, and one is to deeply divide people into two essential groups, to push you know, the villainized side of that division to the furthest extreme possible, and then amplify dynamics that stoke fear. So, you know, if we have Joe Biden, we're going to get rioting and looting, you know, 24/7 through the streets. It's hardly a dog whistle. It's so explicit.
But I want to ask you about something else, Robin. When journalists and political analysts talk about election results specifically, they tend to analyze the candidates' ground games and their ability to reach different voting demographics. But isn't this beyond politics and more about changing the way we think about race as individuals?
Each individual white person tends to think of themselves as outside of racism, right? I don't know that you could have come up with a more effective way to protect systemic racism than reduce it to the very simple formula of good people versus bad people. And that allows you to both express your racism, as Trump does so clearly, and still say, I'm the least racist person in the room. And so even white nationalists will not acknowledge that they are racist, even as their project is in a white ethno state. And so that just is such a setup to have each individual person see themselves as not part of that problem. And what I would offer is that no one could possibly be outside of the forces of racism and systemic racism in this country. And it's on each and every one of us to change our question from if we have been impacted by those forces to how have we been impacted? When the question is if, well, for most white people, the answer is no, not at all. I've, you know, been completely untouched by any racist ideology or messaging or implicit biases. I've been untouched by the culture I live in and so forth. So then what further action is required of me? Well, none. I'm not racist. When we change that question to how have I been shaped by the society I live in, that sets us on a lifelong path, both personally as individuals, but in organizing to address institutional policies and practices. We just can't get where we need to go if we reduce our understanding of what it means to be racist to conscious intention.
I understand exactly what you're saying, but is there a future in the near future where we'll get anywhere close to that? I mean, I'm thinking about no matter who is our president moving forward, this problem is still very much alive and well. Do you think or do you expect Trump's ideology to persist? And is he more a catalyst or a symptom of a bigger problem in our country?
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely a symptom. It's easy to look at him and say, what a terrible person, but he couldn't do what he's done without the tacit collusion of many, many, many people. So yeah, it's disheartening. I'm sure that I am not alone in how heartbreaking this situation is and how discouraging. Yes, we have our work cut out for us. Where I find some encouragement is that both sides, if you will, have been amplified. So while white nationalism and racial animus and resentment are definitely amplified, so is anti-racist activism. And so we just have to be consistent and courageous and never be complacent.
To deepen what you're saying, we do have a habit, though, of calling on Black and brown people to offer solutions on how to end racism. And really, one thing about your work that I'm struck by is that you're basically saying white people are the ones that need to work. They need to do the work to dismantle racism. How can white people normalize calling out their own racism?
Well, I don't think we can normalize it if we don't deepen our understanding of the concept of systemic racism. And that's another thing that does give me some hope, is that that idea is now in the mainstream. As long as we see it as just individual bad actors, we likely are not going to move forward. Everybody has a role. It is critical that we listen to and take leadership from Black and brown people and other people of color. And for far too long, we've offloaded all of this onto people who don't control the institutions. It's as if in relation to patriarchy, men just turned to women and said, okay, solve patriarchy. It's like, no, how about you talk to your brothers and call this out in a way that only you can. But, you know, ultimately the responsibility goes to those who control the institutions and whose bias is backed with legal authority. Right. Again, we all play a part, but those parts are different. And it's on each of us to identify. So what is my part? I'm not a white nationalist, but that does not mean I have not colluded with systemic racism and does not mean that I don't play a role. That's each of our individual work.
That's Robin DiAngelo, author of White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. Thank you so much, Robin.
Oh, you're so welcome, Tonya.
If you're like me, you were glued to screens this week watching the election unfold. But if you're ready for a break, NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has a few ideas. Eric, welcome. And there's actually this evidence from TV ratings that people in these very stressful times are taking comfort in comedies and old TV favorites. What have you been watching?
Yeah, I mean, well, this show isn't quite so old, but Schitt's Creek, S-C-H-I-T-T-S.
Always necessary.
For the FCC. that show is at the top of Nielsen's list, giving you this sense that people are sort of looking for great shows that don't have anything to do with politics. What I've been doing is my 16-year-old son and I both loved The Closer, which was this show on TNT that had Kira Sedgwick playing a deputy police chief in Los Angeles who had this unusual facility for getting confessions out of people. And we also love to watch Law & Order UK. They have some of their own stories, but they also take a lot of classic Law & Order scripts from the Mothership show, and they redo them for the British system. Mm. So in addition to seeing a great crime story, you get a sense of what a legal system is like that's a bit different from America's.
Sure. And I know you're also interested in this new Showtime show. It's called Moonbase 8. It's going to debut this weekend. It's about a couple wannabe astronauts. What do you think? Tell me about that. Is that a good escape from the news?
Well, okay, so this is one of these silly kind of comedies that might take your mind off of where we are now. If Fred Armisen's in it, John C. Reilly's in it, and they've created this show about a team of misfit guys who want to be astronauts. They are training on this deserted base in the middle of the desert that is set up to mimic the conditions of what it would be like if they were on the moon. Mm. And then eventually John C. Reilly is trying to get them to find their confidence, and he gives this very impassioned but ultimately misguided speech, which we have a clip of. Let's check it out.
We are members of the National Association of Space Astronauts.
The what?
NASA.
It's the North American Space Association, right?
Is it? No. That's not it.
It's a national association.
It's not national. Nautical. Nautical, because it started with boats. Nautical Astronomy Society of Adventure.
I don't think it stands for anything. I think it's just a word. NASA.
It's NASA.
NASA. Okay. NASA. We're NASA.
It's funny. It started with boats.
If they don't know what NASA stands for, I don't think they have much of a chance of getting to the moon. But it's a nice little diversion.
Yeah. I know you want to talk about HBO's new show coming out this Monday. It's called Industry. It follows recent college grads at a cutthroat bank in London. Tell us about that one.
Yeah. And you explained it perfectly. You know, we get a look at these young people who are in this really stringent program to try and be part of an investment house in London. We got a clip of a montage of different applicants in this program talking in the entrance interview. Let's check it out.
Why are you here then?
I think mediocrity is too well hidden by parents who hire private tutors. I am here on my own.
Every successful business is full of people who've spent money nurturing unremarkable talent.
I play third fiddle to two figures in my mother's life, Jesus Christ and Margaret Thatcher.
Where do you stand on them?
One's the reason we're all here, and the other's a carpenter.
Very good. What did you think about this one, Eric?
I thought it was pretty good, and it's an example of how a lot of these premium TV services have gotten through the pandemic by getting shows that are from Britain, from the Middle East, and Industry is a good example of that.
Oh, interesting. Well, okay, and we don't have a ton of time here, but let's see if we can get this last one in. The docuseries on Hulu called City So Real, it's actually about, sorry for those who are tired of politics, the Chicago mayoral election last year. And it's by Steve James, the man who is behind the classic Hoop Dreams.
Yeah, so now, at least in this case, we know how it ends, right? We know who got elected mayor in Chicago, so you don't have that suspense hanging over you. But what it really is a portrait of all the different neighborhoods in Chicago. And in fact, you know, we got a clip where they showed a lot of different mayoral candidates visiting the Bud Billiken Parade, which is a parade that's held by the African American community. And there's a great conversation between one of the candidates and a woman who's a spectator. Let's check it out.
I'm 82. As long as I've been here, nothing has really changed.
What do you want to change, though?
I want to see the government work for the people. The people, not the rich.
Still kind of resonant today, right, Eric?
It resonates today. And what's also interesting to me is there seems to be a trend in documentaries where you spend great gobs of time on a subject to give you a sort of an understanding of that subject that accumulates over time. This is a five-hour project. It is an important reflection of what's happening in documentaries these days.
Well, I'll tell you what, everything you've brought here to this show is quite interesting. I look forward to it when I have a minute.
Exactly. Yeah, you won't have a minute quite as quickly as the rest of us.
Indeed. I will live vicariously through you. Eric Deggans, thanks so much.
Quite the pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You can enjoy the TV without me. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.